This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Craig Johnson. He's the author of the series of Longmire books. His new book is called The Highwayman. He will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Now, all your books are set in Wyoming in Absaroka County. Many of the people who, even they might not have read them but seen them on the TV series, they feature Sheriff Walt Longmire and his good friend Henry Standing Bear, whom Walt calls the Cheyenne Nation, calls him the Bear. And this story has a supernatural twist, and we're not sure till the end, and even then, what's going on. And I think it's so interesting because it really highlights the different explanations of what seems like a supernatural appearance of a highway patrolman who has long since passed away. Mm-hmm. To a new highway patrol woman, his sort of like weird apparition really highlights the contrast between the two cultures. The culture of Walt Longmire, mm-hmm. who is a white detective, and Henry Standing Bear, who is really in the native traditions of the region.
Absolutely. Like it was a unique opportunity for a different type of story. One of my favorite ghost stories of all time is a little 13-page short story by Charles Dickens called The Signalman. He's much more well known for his Christmas ghost stories like that, but this is just a little story that he wrote about a train wreck that had happened north of London about the mid-1800s. And it was a unique little story that I thought, you know, had a lot of interesting qualities to it. But the difficulty was that if I was going to try and update something like that, it was almost impossible because of the technology. There really just wasn't, you know, any way to do it because technology, you know, pervades so much of, you know, our lives these days. I mean, here we sit with these headphones on our heads and these amplified microphones sticking in front of our voices. And so it's very apparent to me that technology is a major portion of our lives these days. But then, you know, I've actually ran into a highway patrolman buddy of mine, Jim Thomas, a captain up in Wyoming, and we were discussing, for some reason, the Wind River Scenic Byway, which is this little canyon that runs, you know, about 30 miles through the middle of Wyoming, and it's got these granite cliffs on either side of this 5-grade rapid whitewater river that runs through, and I was talking with him about it, and he said, well, you know what the old-timers used to call the Wind River Canyon? And I said, no, what? And he goes, no man's land. He said, because up until about 10 years ago, when they finally put a tower in the canyon, you couldn't get radio frequency in there. So whenever the highway patrolman would go in the northern end of the canyon, you wouldn't hear from them again until they came out the other end at Boyson Reservoir, like 30 miles away. And that's a unique situation like that I thought. And all I could think was, boy, that might do it. That might be where I can have this story take place. And so I took a smaller character from the books, Rosie Wayman, who was a highway patrolman, and had her transferred over to Troop G. And she's working the Wind River Scenic Byway. And the difficulty being that she's working third watch, which is midnight to late in the morning. And every couple of nights at about 12:34 exactly, she gets a radio call, 1078, officer needs assistance. 1078, officer needs assistance. The problem being that the call is coming from a legendary Arapaho highway patrolman by the name of Bobby Womack, who died back in 1979. And of course, you know, they immediately try and get her to go in for psychological evaluation, and instead she calls up Walt and Henry and says, hey, I need a hand, and they head down.
And the rest unfolds. I thought it was so interesting that one of the characters in the book isn't a person, but the tunnels. Mm-hmm. Those tunnels carved through the granite rock. I assume they're real. I actually did a Google image search to see what they look like.
See, once again, technology rears its head.
Yeah.
Actually, they are real. And one of the, you know, another one of the impetuses, you know, for this storyline was, as I was, I had a little book called The Spirit of Steamboat that was made the One Book Wyoming project. You know, it was like the state read for the state of Wyoming. I mean, here in New Mexico, you've got enough, you know, cities and counties with enough people in them that you can do city and county reads. But in Wyoming, it takes all of us together to do a read. And so we were doing this travel around all over the state, and we were coming back through those tunnels late one night. And as we're going through the third tunnel coming into the canyon, there was a car sitting in the middle of the tunnel with its lights dimming. And I could hear the starter as I was going by. So I thought, oh, that's a problem. Because somebody could come whistling down into that tunnel at about 50, 60 miles an hour and slam right into the back of this poor guy. So I told my wife, I said, go up to the north end of the tunnels, pull across there, with the truck, put the emergency lights on like that, and then get out and wave down anybody that, comes in. I'm going to try and push this guy out. So I went over like that, and it was an older man and he was sweating profusely and turning red. And I said, what's the problem? And he says, I can't get my car to start. And I said, well, make sure you get it in neutral. Get the emergency brake off. Don't put your foot on the brake. Let's start pushing. So I move around to the back of this thing, and it was one of those old Delta 88,000-pound, sedans. And so fortunately, the tunnels are on relatively, level ground. And so I was able to push him out the far end of the first tunnel and get him to the side of the road where his cell phone was able to get through. And we got the highway patrol, and they came, and then there was a tow truck. And so I said, are you okay? And he said, yeah, I'm all right. And so I said, okay. So I started walking back. Well, I don't think very many people walk through those tunnels, especially at night. And I was walking back through those tunnels, and my cowboy boots, are echoing off, the pavement as I'm walking through there. And then something funny kind of happened. And I heard another set of footsteps traveling along behind me. And then another set of footsteps traveling along behind those footsteps. And of course, what it was it was the echo of those three tunnels every time it would go through. And I just thought, boy, I think I can probably use that in a book.
Yeah, all the things you just described are scenes in the book. Try to push a car and hearing a person, and then there actually maybe being another person, but we don't want to ruin it because we want people to read it. But
well, and that's the tricky part. I mean, for me, the fun part about this type of story is to write in the margins, to get out there in the margins of the genre, and not get all Stephen King, where we suddenly have the realities of it or anything like that. But to try and capture those moments, where you think you saw something out of the corner of your eye, where you think you heard something, but you're just not quite sure. And this kind of goes a little bit back to that first question that you asked that I didn't completely answer, which is the two different philosophies that we have in the book. The two main characters of Henry and Walt, and Walt is a detective. He is a detective, and he deals with empirical data. He's going to look for the facts. Nothing but the facts, ma'am. And so for him, the spirituality, the mysticism, all of these type of things, that there could be this specter, this ghost, of this highway patrolman still patrolling the canyon, it doesn't enter into his lexicon. It doesn't like that. But on the other hand, with Henry, who's very steeped in the culture of the Northern Cheyenne, the Arapaho, the Shoshone, and their beliefs system, that that these things do exist and that they are out there. And so whenever Walt's, going through his list of all of the reasons why all of these things could have happened, there's a family that sees Bobby Womack, and Walt's like, well, their car was stuck in the snow. It was carbon monoxide poisoning. There's this hippie that says he got a ride with Walt. And Walt's like, we have no idea what that kid was smoking. There's a whole list of all these reasons why it is that these things could not have happened, or could have happened like that. And of course, then when he finishes up, Henry looks at him and says, yes, you have a ready answer for all of these things, except for the one answer, which would explain all of them, which you refuse to accept.
Right. And what's funny is that Henry takes a kind of Occam's razor approach to it. What is the simplest explanation?
Exactly. And what is the meaning of this, and why? For him, it's much more a question of why would he reappear now, and why would he reappear specifically to this one other highway patrolman who just started, her tour of duty in the canyon? Why is he there? Because of her, because she's the only thing that's changed. So it's kind of a fun mystery to kind of track down.
Right. And I always appreciate your skill and the skill of mystery writers who, you have a limited amount of space in which to introduce these characters. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you think, oh, I should have figured that out. The reader. But of course, I didn't figure it out.
Well, there are dirty little tricks that we mystery writers use. And I'll give you away one of my biggest ones. I put a lot of humor in my books because I just, anybody that's ever had a tough job, certainly law enforcement, in the medical field, teachers, or radio, anyone that's had a tough job knows the only way that you really make it through to the end of the day is by having a sense of humor. You either laugh or you cry at the end of the day. And so for me, the humor becomes a very important part of making the characters fully rounded and realistic. And one of the dirty little tricks that I use is whenever I drop you a clue as to what's going on to help you try and figure out who it is that might have done it or what's going on, I generally do it right when something really funny happens. And there's something about, you know, the human mind where, you know, you'll just skip right over the clue, but you'll remember the funny part. And that's right. That's something that I do, I have to admit.
Well, writers in our out there in radio land, take note. We're talking to Craig Johnson about his new book, The Highwayman, and I wondered, first of all, how you collect the Native American stories and what, like, if you have a set of rules about what you will and won't tell.
Well, I mean, for me, the big issue there is more importantly what they are willing to share, like that, and what they want, you know, to have included in the books. I'm extraordinarily fortunate in the fact that, you know, that my ranch is right there on the Montana-Wyoming border, and so, you know, the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Reservation are immediately to the north of me, and so these are my neighbors, my friends, you know, and practically family. So it's kind of important that I make sure that I get that kind of information correct. It's a little more difficult, I think, when you're starting out because nobody knows who you are or what you're doing or anything like that. But I've been very, very fortunate. The books, you know, have been very successful. And then with the advent of the TV show and all of that, you know, the books and the TV show are very, very popular on the res like that. And mostly because I think, you know, because the Indian characters are not treated with this rubber cliche stamp that says Indian. You know, they're people is what they are.
And there's a lot of them and they're all different.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Like that. I mean, you know, the idea that we can just stamp this big, you know, rubber stamp that says Indian, you know, well, you know what? The Arapaho have very little in common, you know, with the Apache, who have very little in common, you know, with the Pequods. Like, I mean, you know, these are tribal groups. Like, it's like sovereign nations. It's like saying, you know, the French, they're just like the South Africans. You know, it just doesn't work that way. Like that, it's a tribal organizations like that, but they're, you know, they're varied, highly varied. And, you know, you have to treat that with respect. You know, whenever you're writing about it and trying to get that information across, the first thing is it true? Like, you know, you want to make sure that you're not just making stuff up. And then, you know, there's this incredible invention that they have that you know really, really well. It's called Tell Me a Little About Yourself. It's the most seductive words in the English language. And so, you know, I spend a lot of time up on the res, you know, and get the information that I need. Like that. And if I can't get the information that I need from good, close friends, like there's a buddy of mine, Marcus Red Thunder, who I utilize, you know, an awful lot of the time. He's actually the model, you know, for the character of Henry in the books. You know, certainly Henry's sense of humor, like that, and philosophical bent. But, you know, if he doesn't have that information, he can always point me in the direction of somebody that does. And fortunately, the Arapaho and the Shoshone are actually in Wyoming, and so that's not that far. So he has good contacts down there and can hook me up. And so it was important, you know, as far as the language is concerned, as far as the traditions are concerned, you know, the ceremonies were concerned, and also the beautiful imagery. There's a portion in the book where the Shea woman, Kimama, is actually speaking to Walt, and she makes the remark, she asks him the question, she says, you know, she's talking about Bobby Womack when he died in 1979, and she asks Walt, she says, you know how he died? And Walt says, well, yeah, he died in a crash. Like, and she goes, he died by fire. And what happens is every time the embers of his existence, you know, begin to fade away, the wind picks him up and carries him around the planet again, and he becomes alive once more in this canyon. You know, it's beautiful, beautiful, lyrical, you know, legends, you know, that are so easy to use. I mean, because they're just so beautiful.
And as a reader, and as somebody who lives in the West, as you do, I mean, here in Santa Fe and in the area, these things, and this is what's interesting to me about the sort of two cultures, you know, Henry Standing Bear and Walt Longmire, both of their realities, I think to many of us, are equally real.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Like, and they are the two major, you know, I would say, you know, ethnicities, you know, within. You got the mainstream, you know, white culture like that. But then you've also got, you know, the Indian culture. And the Indian culture, and I do say Indian, I don't say Native American, because my Cheyenne buddies make fun of me whenever I try and say Native American. They always look at me and say, where were you born?
Yeah.
And I would say, well, I was born in America. So you would be a Native American too then, wouldn't you? Like, it's a constant source of amusement for them. But nonetheless, you know, for me, I always think, you know, well, okay, my kind of people have only been in this part of the world for a couple of hundred years, right? I look at my buddy Marcus and I think his kind of people have been here for a couple thousand, so I probably need to listen to what it is he has to say.
Let's talk a little bit about the TV series. Longmire was produced by A&E for the first three seasons. Now it's being produced by Netflix. I have watched, binge watched all of them, as many people have.
Well, you know, I mean, Netflix is kind of like a crack dealer. You know, they show you that one episode and then they say, well, you know, the next episode of Longmire will be starting in 8 seconds.
8 seconds, yeah.
Are you sure? You mean, you know, you don't have that much to do. Come on, you should watch another episode.
Right, and eventually, you know you're an addict when you get to the point where it says, are you still
watching? Those are horrible notifications to get.
Like, are you alive?
That's right. It's just, I have a useless life and I'm just sitting here watching television for hours at a time.
But I wondered, what are the continuities, what are the differences between the two production companies? It did feel a little different to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the great thing about, you know, going over to Netflix was is that we were kind of unchained from that 42-minute basic cable format, you know, which is, you know, really, really limiting whenever you're trying to tell a story. But, you know, they had to get their 20 minutes of commercials in, you know, per hour. And since we made the leap over to the streaming penthouse over at Netflix, it's been kind of nice because I have yet to see an episode that's under an hour long.
Yeah.
And that really kind of gives, you know, the show a lot more space to breathe. It really gives the actors a lot more of an opportunity to act and to react, you know, which I think is magnificent because we're fortunate enough to have some really incredible, you know, actors in this show. I mean, Lou Diamond Phillips, Robert Taylor, you know, Adam Bartlett, Cassidy Freeman, A. Martinez. I could go on and on and on about all these incredible actors that we've got. And so to see them be able to do the things that they want to do, you know, but, you know, don't end up on the cutting room floor the way that they did when we were on basic cable is really kind of wonderful.
Is it the same screenwriters? Are you working with a new crew?
No, it's the same. It's the same people. It's just that you're actually getting to see, you know, the full scripts. Like, yeah. It is what you're finally getting to see. I mean, that used to be kind of heartbreaking because, you know, I'm a creative consultant on the show like that, which means I know where the porta potties are on set. But it also means what they do is they send me the scripts like that, and I go through the scripts and read them like that and give them feedback. And you know, the horrifying part of those first 3 years was that I would get the scripts and there would be like an incredible scene, say between Henry and Katie at the Red Pony Bar and Grill. And I would say, oh boy, I cannot wait to see what the actors do with this. This is going to be a great scene. Well, then I'd get the episode and the scene was gone.
Yeah.
And inevitably what had happened was the scene, you know, was cut because the episode was simply too long and they had to cut it back down to that 42 minutes, not 42 minutes and 20 seconds, but 42 minutes. And so an awful lot of really good work, you know, ended up, you know, on the cutting room floor. And now that we're with Netflix, that's really just not the case. I mean, what I get, the full blown script, you know, that I get to, you know, to comment on, that's actually what the viewers actually get to see.
There are, of course, many more episodes than there are novels.
Mm-hmm.
Have all your novels been made into episodes?
No. They use bits and pieces. Like it was very nice, like that, because the producers, the very first meeting that I had with them, one of the first things they said was, "Your books don't easily break down into a 42-minute teleplay,"
right?
Which I was very flattered by, like that, because if they did, I don't think you should be reading them, to be honest. And so, what they said was, "We're going to take bits and pieces, like, you know, from the books, and utilize some of the plots, some of the subplots, and all those type of things." So I think it's worked out, you know, really well for them and also for me, in the sense that, I mean, they're going to have 53 episodes by the time they get done, you know, with this season. I've only written 12 books, you know, and so for me, it's kind of interesting. But I continue to feed them, you know, information, you know, newspaper articles, you know, magazine articles, stories that I hear, all of these things. Because, you know, just because a story doesn't fit, you know, and work for me, you know, as a 350-page novel doesn't necessarily mean that it won't work for them, you know, for one of their teleplays or one of the subplots for whatever it is that they're doing with the show.
Are you also coming up with ideas for the teleplays directly that you're not using in novels?
Yeah, I mean, there have been some things that I've sent them like that just didn't, you know, quite work for me. Like, and I mean, you know, obviously there's a format, you know, to novel writing too. And of course, you know, The Highwayman, you know, breaks that rules a little bit. I mean, I've had two novellas, and they're roughly like about 200 pages in length, you know, and I could, you know, pad them out and make them a full-length book, but they wouldn't be as good, you know? I mean, that's the important thing to me. I mean, when you've been a writer for a while, in many ways, it's almost like being a horse handicapper. You kind of look at a story and you think to yourself, okay, will this one go the distance?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, just because it's not a 350-page idea doesn't mean it's not a good idea. You know, sometimes a 200-page idea, sometimes a 12-page short story idea, it doesn't matter. But there's only two basic genres. There's good writing and bad writing. And I think, you know, what you hope you're doing is the good writing stuff.
The show is filmed in the Santa Fe area.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent does it feel like Wyoming and like what's different for you?
Well, they've done a pretty magnificent job.
I thought so too.
It's like about a 90-mile, I think, perimeter around Santa Fe, like that, which is just it's a beautiful country. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that was kind of funny. Whenever they were telling me they were going to film in New Mexico, I had to laugh, you know, because I said, well, my grandparents lived in Hobbs, which I think is the New Mexico equivalency of U-Cross, where my ranch is, you know, with a population of 25, because most people in New Mexico don't know where Hobbs is. For me, like that, it's a high desert, you know, and so obviously there's some things. Every once in a while you'll spot a cactus, you know, or one adobe building, you know, too many or something like that, that'll give you an indication that maybe it's not in Wyoming. But as a general rule, they've done a pretty fantastic job, you know, of discovering. I mean, they go out. I mean, I think for the pilot episode, we sent them like about 360 some photographs of that area in and around, you know, Johnson, Sheridan County area, you know, the base of the Bighorn Mountains up there on the Montana-Wyoming border. And they went out for like 4 months and scouted locations, you know, so that they could find places that looked like Wyoming. And they continue to do that. You know, John Coveney, one of our producers, was, you know, in the van, you know, all day yesterday scouting locations for an episode that'll get filmed, you know, next week. And, you know, it's a constant battle to find new places like that. But that's something to be said, you know, for the strength, you know, of the New Mexico film industry. You know, whenever I'm talking with people and they say, well, they film it in New Mexico, right? And I'm like, well, yeah, but I can just about guarantee you that just about every single Western you've seen in the last 20 years, if not filmed exclusively in Wyoming, I mean, not exclusively filmed in New Mexico, has been at least partially filmed in New Mexico. It's a very aggressive film commission down here like that. You know, it's what's fantastic is when Richardson was the governor and was able to implement those, with all of the crews, you know, where they actually trained crews down here in New Mexico. And then you've got that incredible, you know, advantage called Greer Garson Studios over here in Santa Fe, like that, which is just an incredible place, you know, to go and film. And they are able to do all the interiors of Longmire into one soundstage.
Is that right? The bar?
Yeah, and all of it.
Oh, very interesting.
All of it. Like, so,
do you set it up and break it down continually?
No. They set it up, you know, for that filming period, you know, that's about 3.5-4 months, you know, and they start in March, you know, and I always laugh when people ask me, well, why don't they film it in Wyoming? And I'm always like, have you been to Wyoming in March? Unless the show is supposed to be taking place in Nome, Alaska.
Right, that probably
wouldn't have worked.
Craig Johnson's new book is called The Highwayman. He will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, dear.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.